It's Friday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama is in Japan and about to stand on hallowed ground in Hiroshima.
Every attack on healthcare disrupts the delivery of health services.
Healthcare workers are at increasing risk around the world. Turkey's economy has rebounded. Will it last? Also ahead, children's art following the first atomic blast. And we go above and beyond. Musically speaking, it's all in today's International Edition. President Obama is taking part in a two-day summit of the world's seven richest democracies in Iseshima, Japan, in part to assess the best way to reignite a global economy. And the International Monetary Fund said last month that it would expand to a modest 3.2% this year. Maritime tensions in the South China Sea and Europe's migration crisis are also on the agenda. Mr. Obama will also make a groundbreaking visit later today to the city of Hiroshima, the site of the dropping of the first atomic bomb at the end of World War II. But the visit and the G7 summit have been overshadowed by Japanese public outrage over the alleged rape and murder of a Japanese woman by a former U.S. Marine who now works at the Kadena military base on Okinawa. Jeff Kingston, Asian studies professor at Temple University in Tokyo, tells VOA's Victor Beatty resentment over congestion, pollution, and crime associated with the U.S. military presence is brimming over in the wake of the latest crime.
This has ignited island-wide protests and a firestorm of anger among Okinawans who have long resented the fact that they host a disproportionate burden, that the 74% of American military facilities in Japan are located in Okinawa, that covers about 18% of the entire landmass. And since 1995, when four servicemen gang raped a 12-year-old schoolgirl, islanders have been exasperated that so little has been done to stop a wave of violent crimes and to reduce the U.S. military footprint in Okinawa. And Abe is very closely associated in the public mind with promoting and sustaining that American military presence.
The G7 summit, the biggest debate will be over how to reignite the global growth engine. What can be done about global growth?
Japan had hoped to line up the G7 finance ministers last week in support of its plan for collective fiscal stimulus to, you know, jumpstart the world economy. But the finance ministers from Germany and the United Kingdom had different ideas. And so this hasn't really worked out to plan for the Abe administration. And so the purposeful collective action that they had sought seems they're going to have to step back a bit and do something less ambitious. I think they still are hoping to get some sort of endorsement of Abenomics, the three arrows of monetary expansion, fiscal stimulus, and structural reforms. But again, this doesn't necessarily play to Abe's favor, because the one thing that everybody complains about is that Abenomics hasn't worked. It's dead in the water, and he's made zero progress on structural reforms.
Are the Japanese people highly anticipating this rather groundbreaking trip by the president to Hiroshima on Friday?
You know, I think that this is very warmly welcomed by the Japanese people, perhaps an overdue visit. And although Obama has clearly stated on Japanese TV that he's not going to go and apologize, he has suggested that he's going to take more responsibility for the taking of innocent lives. So I think that the Japanese people are okay with the fact that he's not apologizing, and they see this as a powerful symbolic gesture of healing. And on that long road from foe to friend, Obama, I think, recognized that this was one of the remaining issues of unfinished business.
Jeff Kingston says Mr. Obama, who received the Nobel Peace Prize for his 2009 Prague speech calling for a nuclear-free world, might make his post-presidency cause. And what better place to draw inspiration about what is at stake than a visit to Hiroshima? We turn now to our social media segment, International Editions. Abby Lee is right here to bring us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, what's always seemed to be buzzing is Donald Trump, the presumptive GOP presidential nominee, securing enough delegates now to clinch his party's nomination. Tell us about that.
He did that. Trump is once again all over the internet. Like you said, he surpassed the 1,237 delegates to become the GOP nominee. He wrote on Facebook, "Honored to say, on behalf of our great movement, we have broken the all-time record for votes in GOP primary history." More than 143,000 people responded to that post, mostly positive responses. People are also talking about a likely debate with Democratic contender Bernie Sanders. Hashtag Bernie Trump debate is trending at this hour after Sanders agreed to it ahead of California primary. Jim, you know what's really bugging me about this hashtag, though?
Know what?
That they use Bernie's first name and then Trump's last name to put in the it's just a reporter problem. Sanders posted this on Twitter and Facebook. "Game on. I look forward to debating Donald Trump in California before the June 7th primary." That is in response to Trump telling comedian Jimmy Kimmel that he would debate Sanders for charity.
Well, that's an interesting choice, and perhaps, gee, you can start a new hashtag on that. How are people responding?
His tweet got more than 44,000 likes, and he also sent out this tweet Thursday afternoon. "I am delighted that Donald Trump has agreed to debate. Let's do it in the biggest stadium possible." You know, Sanders is a bit on the older side and can strike some people as quite gentle, but I think he got some chutzpah to say the biggest stadium. Now, turning to reactions on Facebook, more than 140,000 people liked his post, including activist Sean King and hip-hop artist Mac Lethal. Some of the top comments are about how the American people deserve to see the difference between the two candidates and that it could be the biggest presidential debate in history. Meanwhile, TV journalist Chuck Todd called Trump a walking contradiction, and Todd moderates NBC's Meet the Press. That's all I have for Trump for now, but trust me, we'll be talking about him again. Jim?
Well, somehow I think you're right. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments to our Twitter stream at VOA_IE. And as always, you may tag myself and G on those tweets. We are at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories we're following in Asia: China once disputed South China Sea off G7 agenda. Pakistan claims U.S. scuttled Afghan peace efforts. Death of activist in Chinese custody sparks outcry. Troubled Cambodian leadership tested sorely over beatings. Taj Mahal battles new threat from insects. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app if you happen to have a smartphone. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A new report from the World Health Organization says nearly 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed and more than 1,500 wounded in 19 countries with emergencies, and that many of these incidents were intentional. From Geneva, Lisa Schlein has more for VOA on this report, which covers the past 2 years.
This first effort to consolidate and analyze data on attacks on healthcare in emergency settings around the world sheds light on the severity and frequency of the problem. The findings show widespread violations of international humanitarian law, which, if proven, could amount to war crimes. Rick Brennan is the director of the WHO's Department of Emergency and Risk Management.
Every attack on healthcare disrupts the delivery of health services and denies communities access to essential health services in emergencies the time that they really need them most.
The World Health Organization says a number of hospitals and health facilities in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and elsewhere have been hit with a heavy loss of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkish financial markets were thrown into turmoil this month when its prime minister announced he was stepping down. Calm was restored with the reappointment of the new government, including a prominent global finance expert. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, any financial market euphoria may prove short-lived.
Financial markets recovered most of their losses since the reappointment of Turkey's deputy prime minister Mehmet Şimşek. The reappointment of Şimşek, a former international banker, saw financial markets recover most of their losses they incurred after the ousting of Prime Minister Davutoğlu. Chief economist İnan Demir of Istanbul-based Finans Bank says Şimşek's presence in the new government is seen as a positive gesture by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to international markets.
With Mehmet Şimşek in the government, they at least think that the government is still trying to keep markets, at least to some extent, happy. But the bottom line is that Mehmet Şimşek is unlikely to have a significant room for maneuver.
Şimşek has lost his key role of supervising the country's financial markets, and there are concerns about the future of strict regulation and supervision of the markets introduced in cooperation with the World Bank and IMF following the country's financial crisis. Political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says Erdogan's oversight of economic policy will add to the unease.
Erdogan is already putting his stamp on policies. The policy outlines are shaping up. Erdogan said his concerns regarding low interest rates ought to be treated with more seriousness, meaning that he wants faster rate cuts. I think we're going to see more mega projects. Essentially, Erdogan runs the country.
Analysts warn interest rate cuts could threaten the country's currency, with Turkey having to attract large amounts of foreign capital to finance its trade imbalance. Ankara is also relying on foreign capital to finance the ever-growing list of mega construction projects, including the world's biggest airport and the second longest suspension bridge. More projects are predicted, with Erdogan seeking to boost the economy before an expected referendum to extend his presidential powers. Demir says Erdogan's plans could depend on whether the US central bank ends its policy of cheap money and raise interest rates.
Cheap money is such an important factor for Turkey that it can just gloss over the political uncertainties, the turmoil that you might have in non-economic areas of Turkey. But if the Fed is starting to tighten, after having run significant current account deficits, even with the most prudent of economic policies, Turkey would suffer. There are many examples in economic history of countries who run a large current account deficits and use the financing flows to support construction. That doesn't go on forever.
Some analysts estimate Erdogan's mega projects could cost in excess of $50 billion. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
President Obama is visiting Hiroshima, Japan later today, and he will be the first American president to do so while in office. In August 1945, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on the city to force Japan's surrender in World War II. Although their city lay in ruins, some Hiroshima school children drew remarkable pictures showing hope and peace. The former students and their drawings are now part of a documentary called Pictures from a Hiroshima Schoolyard. VOA's Deborah Block describes the artwork to my international edition colleague, Susan Yaki.
These drawings are really charming. These were elementary school children, and they were drawing things like, you know, playing with their friends, putting flowers in, playing with dogs, playing games, and their city was in ruins. So a lot of these things weren't really real at that time. They were very colorful. And they really showed messages of hope and peace. They did those drawings that way because their teacher had told them to create some happy images. So these young students thought, well, what would make me happy in life? So they did drawings that they felt would make them happy and perhaps lead the way to a better future.
How did this film come about?
Well, the film was developed a few years ago by local people in Washington, one of Japanese heritage who was born in Hiroshima. She saw these pictures, these drawings, in the basement of Old Souls Church in Washington, D.C. Those pictures had been in the basement in a box for quite a few years, really largely forgotten. And as soon as the co-producer of the film, Shizumi Shigeto Minali, saw them, she thought, we have to do a film on this. This is an incredible find. And so the pictures were brought out, they were restored, and eventually they were sent back to the elementary school, which, believe it or not, is still standing today. The concrete outside managed to survive the atomic blast, and then the inside has been done over the years. And then these now aged students, who were now 70 years and up, got to see these pictures that they hadn't seen since they were children.
And what kind of response did they have?
Oh, the response was just overwhelming by a lot of them. Some of them laughed, remembering that they drew them and really remembering in some ways that they had had a good childhood despite the ruins of their city and in many cases losing parents and loved ones. Others were in tears. Again, thinking back to those times. Another woman said in the film that she had put things in her drawing that really weren't in existence at that moment, and that she wished that such things existed, which is why she drew them.
Isn't it amazing that these little kids, in all the ruins and losing family members and all the horror that was around them, that they could reach inside of themselves and think of peace and love?
You know, Susan, that's really what the idea of this entire film is about. It's about children and forgiveness and looking forward. When I spoke with the co-producer, Shizumi, she said that Japanese culture really has a huge feeling about forgiveness, that if you don't forgive, you just remain bitter. So the thinking of many people, even though the city had been destroyed, even though people had been killed and hurt, was to think ahead, to think we can either hold this in our hearts and be bitter, or we can think of a better future and try to move on to a better world, which is peaceful.
VOA's Deborah Block. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. They're known for their pulse-pounding trance tracks, but now the British-based trio Above and Beyond is touring with a total acoustic setup. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the three DJs have traded turntables and headphones for harps, pianos, and guitars.
Most of the time when you attend an Above and Beyond show, you get something like this. That's what the trio, John O'Grant, Tony McGinnis, and Paavo Siljamaki, brought to more than 1 million people on a beach in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But it's their acoustic recordings that have gotten them into some of the most prestigious venues in the world. They released an unplugged album featuring some of their hits 2 years ago to good success. However, Paavo Siljamaki says the group wanted to do more.
It left us with a real sort of itch to do it again. It felt like we hadn't done enough, or it was nicer than we had initially predicted to play together, and then to have an audience like we had at the Greek really made sense of it all. So that was really why we decided to do acoustic, to have a chance to do it again.
Ooh,
During their current tour, the band has sold out the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, the Sydney, Australia Opera House, and the Hollywood Bowl. Electronic DJs usually cannot play such venues because of volume restrictions. But Tony McGinnis says the acoustic concerts have opened a door the group never thought it would go through.
We sort of Trojan horse our way into some of these incredibly prestigious venues. I mean, we walked on stage at the Greek Theatre having only done four gigs, really. And what band gets to do the Greek Theatre after doing four gigs? I can't think of any, you know. We kind of leapfrogged all that kind of years of trailing around the small clubs by bringing our electronic audience to these acoustic venues.
We were in heaven, you and I. And when I lay with you and close my eyes, our fingers touch the sky.
During its current tour, Above and Beyond is traveling with a 15-piece ensemble. Tony McGinnis sings and plays guitar, mandolin, and ukulele. Paavo Siliamaki plays the piano, vibraphone, and cello. Jono Grant plays the Rhodes piano, guitar, and vibes. When they play the Hollywood Bowl, Above and Beyond will perform with a full 32-piece orchestra. Paavo Siliamaki says the idea of performing at the storied venue still seems unreal.
And I know the electronic and the acoustic are connected, but the fact that, you know, it took us 15 years of touring to be able to, you know, do a show at the Madison Square Garden, and here we are with acoustic, that's actually a really new thing for us. And we can bring it to Hollywood Bowl, which is actually even a bigger venue, so it feels feels a little unreal, this whole thing. It'll feel real once we're actually on stage doing it, but until then, I don't know.
Above and Beyond's new album, Acoustic 2, goes on sale June 3rd. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
All of us at International Edition, thank you so much for joining us. For Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Carl Starling, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of the Lake Chad Basin have much to look forward to, said Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his recent visit to Nigeria. Their energy, their ingenuity, reflected in young people across the region, points the way towards a future for the Lake Chad Basin defined by growth, by opportunity, by dignity. Nonetheless, they must first rid themselves of a great, dangerous storm clouding that bright future. The fight against Boko Haram is a fight for this future, one that unlocks the potential of all people, the prosperity of nations, and peace for the entire region, said Deputy Secretary of State Blinken. Over the last year or so, the Lake Chad Basin countries have made considerable progress in degrading Boko Haram, and we commend all of them, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Benin, for standing up the multinational joint task force tasked with ending the Boko Haram insurgency. The United States is deeply committed to supporting this fight and will continue to provide to the task force advisors, training, and necessary resources. But victory on the battlefield is not enough to ensure the lasting defeat of Boko Haram. For that, Boko Haram's ideology must be nullified through government provision of civilian security and civil administration. Human rights abuses must be investigated and abusers held to account. Civilian-military relations must improve. And finally, communities suffering under Boko Haram's heavy fist must be liberated and stabilized, the people provided with humanitarian assistance, basic services, and economic opportunity. If we fail to adopt and pursue this comprehensive approach, we may well defeat Boko Haram on the battlefield, only to be confronted by Boko Haram 2.0 that rises from its ashes, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. As we look ahead to the future, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, the hard challenges of this moment are matched by the promise and potential of this region. We are confident that the Lake Chad Basin countries, with support from the United States, France, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and other international partners, will win this fight and set this region on a course to realize a better future. Let us now turn our unity of vision into sustained unity of action.